For today's subject, it's merely an introduction. I'll be covering some general material with regard to archaeology. Unfortunately, we don't have time in the course to get into any depth at all as far as field work, as far as the processing of archaeological materials, theory of archaeology. There's a whole host of subjects that we could delve into. But my emphasis here is on discoveries that relate to the Bible that will help you in your knowledge of the Bible. And I'm going very light on the theoretical aspects of the subject. I assume most of you, probably all of you, will simply be people interested in the use of archaeology for Bible study, for your knowledge of the Bible, and you don't plan on becoming field archaeologists. So I'm going to give you enough methodology and things along this line just to help you understand the material that you'll be working with. You need to have some understanding of some terminology and so on. So that's what we'll be getting into. Now, the reading assignment from Scoville is quite lengthy, but try to plow through that because it's all very important material. A lot of it deals with something of the background, the history of the discipline of biblical archaeology. Incidentally, today most people prefer the term Palestinian archaeology, which is kind of a somewhat neutral term. Many scholars object to connecting Bible with the archaeology because they feel that has some religious overtones. And so to neutralize the subject somewhat, they use the term Palestinian archaeology. But it's still biblical archaeology. I don't care what they call it. Because our best knowledge of the area is the Bible. And you're going to have to use the Bible if you're going to understand at all the history of the culture of the area of Palestine. So the Bible plays a very important part in this area. But some have felt that the field, the discipline, has been somewhat marred by those in the past who have gone into the field seeking evidence to prove the Bible, to support the Bible, and they feel this is the wrong approach. Now, personally, I had no problem with that, but many scholars would feel that there's a certain bias in the approach, and it's not academic, it's not scholarly. So there's been, in recent years, a push to separate Bible from the archaeology, although many people don't go along with that idea, particularly the Israelis. They think it's very appropriate to refer to this discipline as biblical archaeology, but there's others who disagree. My degree, for example, is in Syro-Palestinian archaeology. This is what they call the field in certain universities. But as I said, it's really biblical archaeology when you come right down to it. So to begin with, let's define a few terms and just talk in general what this whole subject of archaeology is about. Question.
When you say it's Syro-Palestinian archaeology, do you mean no difference about extension?
Depends on your definition. Syro, of course, refers to Syria, the area of Syria. Palestine, pretty much the area of modern Israel. W.F. Albright, who's been called the father of Palestinian archaeology, or biblical archaeology, he felt the entire Near East encompassed the subject of biblical archaeology because you have contributions from Mesopotamia, from Egypt, from the whole region, things that contribute to our knowledge of the Bible. So he had a very broad definition of what biblical archaeology was all about. So it depends how you want to define it. Now, as far as time is concerned, we have to restrict ourselves because we're not going to deal with the Stone Age cultures. Biblical history really begins in the early Bronze Age, so that's where we more or less begin our course. We're not dealing with Paleolithic, Mesolithic, and all of these very supposedly early cultures. The dating is somewhat problematic in some of these early cultures, but we begin with the early Bronze Age, and that's really where biblical history begins. When you talk about Palestinian archaeology, that could include the early cultures as well, and later cultures too. In a way, biblical focuses you on the period of the Bible. Palestinian archaeology opens it up as far as chronology is concerned to cultures earlier, cultures later. Okay, well, let's begin with the word archaeology. What do we mean by archaeology? Now, I'm sure many of you are Greek scholars. I'm not a Greek scholar. But the word archaeology comes from two Greek words, archaeos, meaning what? Yeah, old, ancient, yes. And then the second part of the word comes from the Greek word logia, which would mean study of. Okay, so basically we're talking about the science or the study of ancient things. Well, interestingly, both of those Greek words appear together in John 1:1. In the beginning, or way back, early in time, was the Word. And of course, the Greek there is logos, coming from the same root, logia. So, in the beginning, was the Word. The Word was God, and the Word was God. So we have both elements of the word archaeology appearing close together there in the New Testament. So in general terms, archaeology is the study of ancient things. Now, ancient things could be something 5,000 years old, or it could be something 100 years old. Depends on your perspective, your interest, what you're doing your research on. In this country, if something is 200 years old, we say, wow, that's very old. But in the Middle East, if something's 2,000 years old, they consider, well, that's fairly recent. That's Roman period. That's new. Something isn't ancient until it's 2000 BC. Now you're getting back in ancient times. So depends on your perspective. So you could study colonial America and be doing archaeology, or you could be studying the Sumerians and be doing archaeology, and they're separated by a good distance in time and in space, but it's still archaeology. You're still studying something from the past, something that's old, something that's ancient. Now, in biblical archaeology, we, of course, are narrowing our focus. Now, in general terms, archaeology, as the term is used today, the purpose of it would be to reconstruct the political, economic, social, and cultural history of man. The political, economic, social, and cultural history of man. That's a broad definition of what archaeology is all about. When we narrow that down to biblical archaeology, of course, we're talking about the period of the Bible, and we're talking about the world of the Bible. So we're not interested in South American archaeology, or we're not interested in colonial America or something like that. We're interested in the Middle East from the early Bronze Age up until the Roman period, and from just the areas that would relate to the world of the Bible, Mesopotamia, Syria, Palestine, and Jordan, and Egypt, primarily what is referred to as the Fertile Crescent. Incidentally, to back up for one minute, as far as what we'll be able to cover in the class, if you notice on page one of the syllabus, we're covering the Bronze Age from Adam to Gideon. In the time we have, we just cannot possibly cover the entire Old Testament unless I'm very sporadic in my coverage. And so I have chosen to cover the Bronze Age. And if there's sufficient interest, if the powers that be decide to have further courses in archaeology, we can have Old Testament archaeology too, and go into the Iron Age, which would cover the time from Gideon on to the end of Old Testament history, Esther, in that time frame. And then we could also go into New Testament archaeology, maybe the Dead Sea Scrolls in the New Testament or something like that. So we're not going to cover the entire field of biblical archaeology in this course. It's simply not possible to do that. Now, what are we talking about when we talk about biblical archaeology? All right, we've narrowed it down in terms of time and space, what we're dealing with. But specifically, what are we trying to learn from biblical archaeology? What's the purpose of it? What's the value of it? Why should we study it? Why should Christians be interested in or concerned about archaeology? Well, the Bible, of course, gives us a history of God's dealings with man. So it talks about things that happened in the past. It gives us a record of these events. Since archaeology is a study of the past, archaeology can shed a lot of light on the history that we have in the Bible. So that would be the primary purpose, I think, of biblical archaeology, would be to illuminate the biblical text, to give us background information about the world of the Bible, the culture of the peoples of those times. The Bible many times refers to something very briefly, simply in passing. And yet archaeology can open up this subject to us and give us a more in-depth understanding. An example that comes to mind is when Hezekiah was preparing for the siege of the Assyrians. It mentions very briefly, this is at his death, where it refers to his accomplishments. It says, Hezekiah brought the waters of the Gihon spring into the city of David, or words to that effect. There's two references, two passages, one in Kings and one in Chronicles, and they're both a little different. But that's all it says. Well, we have found that tunnel that Hezekiah had made at that time. It's very well dated. We'll talk about it in a class later on. But we find that this was a tremendous engineering feat. In fact, we cannot explain it today, how they cut that tunnel. So something that's very briefly mentioned, it of course wasn't that significant as far as the spiritual history of Israel and the great events that were taking place during Hezekiah's reign. This is kind of a mundane engineering type of accomplishment, but archaeology has illuminated this thing for us, and so now we know a lot about it. And there's many examples like that. Take the people of the Bible, the personalities of the Bible. They're just lifeless names to us many times, but archaeology can bring these figures to life. Sennacherib, king of Assyria. Well, who's Sennacherib? We read he campaigned, and, you know, he destroyed many cities. He wanted to take Jerusalem, but he was turned back through a miracle. We know all about Sennacherib. We found his palace. We have his records. We have his likeness. So we have all this information about Sennacherib, all this information about the Assyrians. We have their archives, their history. So it brings a personality, a people to life for us. We know all about the culture of the Assyrians. We know all about their religion, how they conducted warfare. So when we read in the Bible about the Assyrians coming into Judah and destroying all the fortified cities, well, we read on about other things, and it doesn't mean too much to us, but we have reliefs that shows the Assyrian army, their military tactics. It shows the soldiers, how they dress, their weapons, and it brings the whole thing to life. And we realize what the people of Judah were up against when the Assyrian army came into the land. So these are just some examples of how the findings of archaeology can really bring to life biblical history, biblical events, and in many ways give us a better appreciation for the Bible. We take the Bible very much for granted. It's always been around. It's always been there on the shelf at home. And many of us have heard these stories since we're little children. And it really doesn't register to us the significance of the events of the book itself. And I think archaeology can put a lot of things into perspective for us. It's been stated that the findings of archaeology have revolutionized our knowledge of the world of the Bible. And I don't think that's an understatement at all, because we just have so much information now about the ancient peoples of Bible times and history and culture and so on and so forth. So that would be the number one, I think, purpose of biblical archaeology, would be to illuminate the Bible for us, Old Testament and New Testament. Now, another aspect of that, I don't know if it should be called illumination or what, but the findings of archaeology help us to understand the languages that the Bible was written in. The Hebrew, the Aramaic, and the Greek of the New Testament. Before the findings of archaeology, we had no ancient texts to compare with the Bible. There are many words in the Old Testament that appear only once. And so we're hard-pressed sometimes to really understand the meaning of these words. And if we can find them in another context, in another ancient document, then it really opens up the meaning of the word for us. Not only individual words, but structure, poetry, the way the ancients expressed themselves. In many ways, these ancient literary documents that have come to light through archaeology help us, again, to understand the ancient Near Eastern mind and the literature of that day and the languages of that day. For example, when we come to the creation stories and the flood stories, we'll talk more about these, I think it's next week. One of the prevailing theories amongst liberal critical scholars is that the biblical accounts have been copied from Babylonian creation and flood stories. And one piece of evidence they used was a word that appears in the first chapter of Genesis, Tihon, which is the word for the primordial ocean, the waters. And they said, well, this is a very late word. It appears in a Babylonian text from 1000 B.C. or something. I forget the exact date. Therefore, the biblical story is a very late story and was copied from this Babylonian creation story. Well, then they found a great archive at Eblon. And again, we'll talk about this later on in our course. But there at Ebla, in this archive that dates back to the early Bronze Age, about 2250 BC, here's the word Tihon in their text. And so now, that has removed that particular argument for trying to put a late date on the creation story, because that word is a very ancient word. And we have many examples along that line that establish the antiquity of our text and, in many ways, the reliability of our text. We can see that it's set in a certain time period in the history of the ancient Near East. It's not something that was dreamed up later on and backfitted or something that was made up to provide a history of Israel, for example. Because we have literary forms, we have words and archaisms that put us back in the very early period. So, again, archaeology is very helpful in elucidating our knowledge of the biblical text, the language of the Bible. Also, archaeology authenticates the Bible. Now, we don't really need to authenticate the Bible. It's God's Word. And I think we can establish the truth of the Bible through our own personal experience. We don't need archaeology to convince us that the Bible is God's Word. But many would take issue with the concept that the Bible is a divinely inspired book. In fact, they come up with an alternative explanation of how we got the book. It was written by man, there were many editors, and the composition took place over a long period of time, and so on and so on. And so they'll try to explain it away as simply a composition of man, and they will further state that anything before the time of Saul is unhistorical, legendary, and so it never really happened. So archaeology can play a role in clarifying the record, so to speak, setting things straight. I tell people as I go around lecturing about archaeology that we don't need to prove the Bible. What we need to do is disprove the critics. And I'm very much involved in that, in the ministry I'm in, the Associates for Biblical Research. We're not out to prove the Bible. We believe it's the Word of God. We believe it's historically accurate. And we don't need archaeology to reinforce that belief. But there are others who don't share that, and in fact, who criticize the Bible, attack the Bible, turn people away from the Bible, and we feel it's incumbent upon us as evangelicals to set the record straight. And so in the ministry I'm involved with, we are doing research in problem areas where there seems to be a discrepancy between the findings of archaeology and the Bible. And we're trying to come up with the evidence that supports the biblical account of things. And we'll get into some of these problem areas further along in the course. There's a very strange attitude amongst scholars about the Bible. And that is, the Bible is wrong unless you can prove it's right. It's guilty unless proven innocent. And this is very strange, because this doesn't apply in any other area. Any other ancient document is assumed to be correct unless you can prove it's not correct. But not so with the Bible. And so we have to come up with extra-biblical evidence to support the truth and the historicity of the Bible. Now, I said that the scholars today would, most liberal scholars, would hold that anything before the kingdom period is legendary. They're folk stories, they never happened. Now, the reason that scholars would say that in the kingdom period and beyond, that this is historical, that these things really happen, is because of the extra biblical evidence. They can't deny it. We have the Assyrian archives that talk about the very things that are recorded in the Old Testament. And so we know these things happened, and we have the names of kings in the Old Testament, and we find those kings really ruled in Assyria and Egypt and so on. And so there's no getting around the fact that from Saul onward, we're dealing with history. Now, when you get earlier than that, we don't have this kind of extra biblical documentation to back up biblical history. And so therefore, these critics say those things never happen. And so that's, I mean, they would say the things in Samuel and Kings and Chronicles never happened if we didn't have the Assyrian records. I'm sure they would. In fact, before the Assyrian records, they did say that. Scholars said there was never a captivity and things of this sort. So archaeology can authenticate our biblical records. Question?
It seems to me that the Bible has always undergo like wire the second documents.
No. Right.
I wonder what are the reasons. Secondly, I wonder if one of the reasons is because Bible records miracle events, miracle supernatural phenomena, while Zechariah cannot prove that or authenticate miracle events in the Bible. And when you say authenticate the Bible, archaeology, how do you deal with?
Yes, archaeology can only go so far, of course. It can only deal with the history and culture of the Bible. You can't prove the miracles. And so, ultimately, I don't care how much archaeology you have, it's faith. You have to accept the revelation in the Bible by faith, and that's the whole basis of our relationship to God. But archaeology can play an important role in establishing the historicity of those events. Now, you're quite right that scholars use a different set of standards when they're dealing with the Bible than they do other documents. They say the Bible's a religious book, and therefore you can't believe anything it says because it's biased. The authors were trying to support a particular theological position and so on and so on. But when you look back at any ancient document, they're all religious texts. They all talk about their gods and this and that with regard to the battles they fought and the victory the god gave them and so on. But that doesn't matter. Scholars, even though those ancient texts are religious, scholars look at them differently because they talk about a god we know is not a real god. The God of the Bible is a real god, and it's a spiritual problem. That's really what it is underneath. It's a spiritual problem when people approach the biblical text. I relate it or compare it to the problem with evolution. And you can probably elaborate on this a lot more than I can. But the problem is not with the scientific data. It's how it's your predisposition, your ideas, whether you will accept a supernatural being that brought the world and the universe into being, or whether you can't accept that and you've got to have a natural explanation for things, well, then you're going to support evolution. And you'll make the scientific evidence fit your ideas, but that just as well fits the idea of a creator. And so it has nothing to do with the scientific evidence. It's a person's predisposition. And it's the same way in dealing with the Old Testament history. It's not a problem with the data at all. It's how people want to view the book. And it's the spiritual battle that's underlying these problems. Yeah.
Is it that they have a different, a double standard, or do they use the secular standard on the Bible to look at Israel's God is just another national god, and these are the Israelite political religious archives? Do they look at it like that? Or?
Yeah, but they say that it can't be historically accurate because of this bias of the writers.
And they never say that about the secular
archive? They might, but it's different in that they would assume it's correct unless you can prove that it's not correct. But with regard to the Bible, you assume it's wrong unless you can prove it's right. You know, there's a, like you say, double standard involved. Yeah.
In reference to the areas of the Biblical account is coming, it begins just in the point of departure is Bronze Age. And why not?
Yeah, that's a good point. As far as history is concerned, we begin in the Bronze Age, we have written records at that point. Now, when you're dealing with the creation and the flood and all this stuff, I relegate that to another area outside of biblical archaeology, although we have some records, and we'll talk about the records, you know, of creation and the flood and that. But we're dealing with geology and maybe anthropology and some other disciplines to go back into those very early times. When I talk about archaeology, I'm really talking about the historical period, and it sort of begins with Abraham, really, although maybe even some of his ancestors come into the historical period. So that's why I say archaeology really begins in the Bronze Age. Yeah. Well, let's take a 10-minute break, and we'll continue with our introduction.
When I was growing up, we were allowed to pray in school. Mm-hmm. It was a public school.
Yes. That's pretty much, recent. All right, well, let's get underway for our second hour. So I'd like to begin to zero in a little bit more now on what archaeology is all about and what we're going to be dealing with. When we say archaeology is the study of ancient things, actually what we mean is that we're going to study the material remains from man's past. Although I suppose we could study some ancient documents, some ancient histories. When we talk about archaeology, we're talking about things that have been recovered that are from the past. An ancient document that's contemporary with the events that it's recording, rather than, say, some classical writing that's been handed down or something of that sort. So when we come to the material remains from man's past, we can put it into two broad categories. First would be the written remains, written documents. And then the other group would be the what I call the unwritten documents. Now, the written documents will be our most significant findings, because an unwritten document is silent. It has to be interpreted. But the written document speaks to us. It tells us something. It's a voice from the past. And so it becomes extremely important for reconstructing man's history and culture. So our written documents then are the most important discoveries from archaeology. It's not the gold coffin of King Tutankhamun in Egypt. As valuable as that is, it really doesn't tell you a lot about life in ancient Egypt. I tell you a little bit about the pharaoh and his wealth, but it doesn't tell you anything about the history of his reign or what they believed, how the common man lived. But through the written materials from the reign of king, Tutankhamun, which are not worth anything to, other than their, I suppose, their ancient value, but it's not like gold. But those written documents open up that period for us and tell us a lot about it. The documents are recorded on various types of material. Of course, we only can discover those documents that have survived through the ravages of time, the elements. We find many of these ancient documents written on stone. When a document is written on stone, we refer to that as a stele. And in the handout, I gave you some definitions of terms, and you should find that there. And so that list should be helpful as we're going along here to see how some of these words are spelled. And we find many times there are different spellings. This particular word can be S-T-E-L-E or S-T-E-L-A. You'll see it's spelled both ways, stele or stela, and then the plural stele. So this would be a stone slab with writing on it. In antiquity, the kings and officials many times wanted to memorialize their deeds or some code of laws that they came up with or something of that sort. And so they will write it in stone so it will last forever. And fortunately for us, they did that because these stones have survived and we have them now for our study today. Occasionally they wrote on metal, but this would not normally survive unless it was in a very dry area. Anything written on metal would normally just deteriorate, rust away if it was subjected to any kind of a damp climate. But we do have the occasional metal with writing on it. In antiquity, the city gates were many times covered with copper. And lots of times the king, the monarch, would write some kind of an inscription on that copper coating over the wooden gate. And we have a few examples of the fragments of these gates surviving with writing on it. There's a very famous one from Assyria called the Balawat Gate. It's in the British Museum. Great high thing. It must be 10 feet high, covered with inscriptions and reliefs, pictures. Just a beautiful thing. Recently in Israel, at the site of Lachish, they found a fragment of a gate with the name of Ramses III on it. Very important discovery because it allows us to date the level that it was found in. So occasionally we have some metal with writing on it. Another very famous example is the copper scroll found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls. And of course, because it's so dry there along the Dead Sea, it has survived along with the leather scrolls. And undoubtedly, the ancients did a lot more writing on metal, but we don't have it. They wrote on clay, particularly in Mesopotamia, because they did not have other types of material to write on. They had very little wood or even metal. They didn't choose to use animal skins, or if they did, we don't know about it. But clay was very plentiful. And so they would simply take some clay and fashion it into a flat tablet and then impress their record, their document, into the clay. Now, we have a name for the type of writing that was used on those clay tablets. They would use a stylus for impressing the signs and symbols of their language. And the end of the stylus was wedge-shaped. And so the characters have a wedge shape to them. And the writing is called cuneiform writing, which simply means wedge-shaped. And this is the writing of ancient Mesopotamia, the ancient Babylonians and Assyrians. The language is also referred to as Akkadian. It's a kind of a symbolic pictorial language. It grew out of a picture language, and they have thousands of signs in that language, very difficult to master. In fact, the person would have to devote his lifetime to the study of the language, and then after many, many years, after he had mastered it, then he would become a scribe and could produce written documents himself. It's a very complex, cumbersome system growing out of a pictorial type of a language. So that's the cuneiform written on clay tablets. And we have these clay tablets by the tens of thousands from Mesopotamia and from Syria. Again, since they were made of clay, they have survived the ravages of time, particularly if they were baked. And the more important ones would have been baked in a kiln, fired in a kiln, similar to pottery. And so then they would survive. The ancients also wrote on leather skins, which is called parchment, and that's from about 200 BC onwards. And the most famous discovery of documents written on parchment, of course, are the Dead Sea Scrolls. In Egypt, they wrote on papyrus. Now, papyrus is sort of like paper. It's made out of the reed called, not papyrus, but some fancy Latin name that's similar to papyrus, I forget just now. But anyway, it's a reed that grew along the Nile River in antiquity. And they would take this reed and split it, open it, and pound it flat and dry it. It was an elaborate procedure. And then they would weave it together to form a sheet and flatten it out and so on, and it would become almost like a sheet of paper, and they would write on that with ink, pen and ink. So in Egypt, it's very dry, and papyrus has survived, and we have a lot of papyrus documents from Egypt. Now, they might have used papyrus in Canaan, but we don't know. Certainly they used a lot of parchment in later antiquity, but it would not survive only along the Dead Sea, where it's very dry. Another very common writing material in the land of Palestine was broken pieces of pottery. There was pottery everywhere. And so it was very handy to just take a piece of broken pottery and with pen and ink write on that broken piece of pottery. Many times letters were written on broken pieces of pottery and sent off. And we have recovered quite a number of letters from the Iron Age in particular, written on pottery. And in this case, again, there's a special term. But when that sherd has writing on it, then it becomes an ostracon, singular, ostraca, plural. So that's primarily the types of materials that we find writing on. There's some other occasional other types of material, but this covers the major categories, I think. Probably they wrote on wood, but again, it has not survived for us to find today. Written documents are very rare in Palestine. We have a few stone monuments with some writing on, quite a number of the ostraca, and of course the Dead Sea Scrolls. But compared to Mesopotamia, where we have tens of thousands of these clay tablets, compared to Egypt, where we have a lot of monumental inscriptions on temples and the papyrus findings, compared to those two areas, we have very little written material in the area of Palestine. Now, having said that, we do have a very complete record of the history of the area and the culture of the area because of the Bible. The Bible has survived down through the centuries. And so it is a very valuable source of information about the ancient times of that area. So even though we don't find a lot of written material in our excavations, we have the Bible. It tremendously illuminates the history of Palestine. And even though a lot of material has been found in Mesopotamia and Egypt, in some ways we don't have as a complete a record of those areas as we do of Palestine because of the Bible. Now, when we come to the unwritten documents, we're talking about everything else that the archaeologists dig up. Now, when we think of archaeology, we usually think of digging in the ground, and that's normally what you do as an archaeologist. But it doesn't have to be digging in the ground. There's a lot of ancient material that's right on the surface of the ground. If you go to Egypt, for example, you'll see ancient temples just, you know, right there, that are thousands of years old. Many scholars are involved in the study of these monuments and the inscriptions that are written on these monuments. So they don't have to do a bit of digging. It's right there on the surface. We also do what we call surface surveys, where if we want to determine the habitation in an area, we'll simply go into the area and walk over the ground looking for artifacts, mainly pottery, because wherever there was an ancient site, there would be pottery. And so by doing a surface survey, you can find out where the ancient sites were located, and also from the pottery that you find there, just right on the surface of the ground, you can determine pretty well the time period of the site. So this does not involve any digging at all. I've been involved in several surveys, and you get a lot of very valuable information from these surveys. So we don't always have to be digging in the ground, but most of our material is in fact buried today in the ground, and so we have to excavate in order to recover the material from antiquity. Another question that people often have is, well, how does this stuff get buried? It's a little bit hard for us to understand living in North America in a culture that's only 200 years old. But if you're observant, you'll notice that when they resurface the road, for example, they put another layer right on top of the previous layer. And if you can picture that going on for thousands of years, it builds up, it builds up, it builds up. In antiquity, the common building material was mud brick. They might use stone for foundations. They might even use stone for a very important building like a temple or a palace. But the ordinary buildings were constructed of mud brick normally. After a building went out of use or a town was abandoned or it was destroyed, this mud brick, of course, would collapse and decay and more or less turn into dirt. So the next people that came along would simply level off the area and build on top. And this would be repeated time after time after time. So over the course of the centuries and the millennia, you get a buildup of material and you get this layering of various cultures and occupational phases. So that's basically how the material gets buried, is because of this continual destruction and rebuilding process that took place over a very long period of time. So you could have a site of a town that started on a level area, a flat area, and then over time built up and built up and built up until it's 50 feet high. And the whole thing is totally artificial. And we have many examples of that. And we refer to these artificial mounds as tells. The Arabic is T-E-L-L and the Hebrew is T-E-L, but they both mean the same thing. It's an artificial mound built up by occupation over a long period of time. Well, at any rate, usually we find ourselves excavating to recover this material from antiquity, and normally in Palestine what we recover are the unwritten documents. Very rarely do we find a written document. So what are these unwritten documents? Well, we find the remnants of the buildings that the people constructed. Usually, as I mentioned, they would build a foundation of stone. And so many times we find the foundations of their buildings. This enables us to get the floor plan of the building. Many times those stones were robbed out and reused later on to make a new building. But usually you can discern where the foundation trench was, where they took the stones from. And you can still get the plan of the building if you're a good excavator. So we can recover then the plan of their buildings. And this gives us a lot of valuable information about how people live. We can discern temples, palaces, various types of buildings from antiquity. We spend a lot of time investigating the fortification systems. And this is always very interesting. Again, usually we only find the foundation level, because typically the first few courses would be of stone, and then the superstructure would be of mud brick. So we excavate the walls of the cities, we excavate the gateways of the cities, and quite a bit of effort is expended to recover the plan and the dating of the fortification system. Again, this tells us something about the people, the culture, whether it was a fortified settlement or unfortified. If it's fortified, first of all, that tells you that they were protecting themselves against something or someone. So it was a time of warfare. And so that tells us a little bit about the situation of that time period. It tells us something about their social organization, because to build a city wall and a city gate, you've got to organize your manpower. You've got to have workers to do that. You've got to have some engineering ability and so on. So the study of the fortifications tells us quite a bit about the ancient site that we're excavating. We recover a lot of the household vessels that the people used in antiquity. And this is the pottery. And in fact, this probably comprises 99% of the material that we excavate, pottery. Now, pottery is very helpful and useful, and in fact, it's what we spend most of our time studying. Because it's there, so to speak. It's what we find. It's what has survived. Now, the reason it has survived, of course, is because the ancient potters, to make these vessels durable and useful, fired them in a kiln. And once they were fired in a kiln, these vessels became indestructible. They became hard as stone. Now, you can break the vessel, of course, but the pieces will remain. So, pretty much all the pottery vessels made in antiquity are with us today somewhere. They're in the ground, they're on top of the ground, they're somewhere out there. And so there's all this vast, tremendous quantity of material produced in antiquity that has survived that we can study. And we learn a lot from pottery. Mainly we use it for dating purposes, because the style changed through time. Question?
It seems to me that most of the people that I can say that you cannot use archaeology to set the kind of Bible. And then I wonder what's the use of the part-time pottery.
Well, that's not true. Pottery can be used to date our archaeological materials within a range. and we have some problem areas, but once you straighten out the chronology and the dating of the pottery, it can be used for dating purposes within plus or minus 25 years maybe, sometimes even closer than that. Now, as far as determining biblical chronology, that's a separate issue because the Bible has its own internal chronology, and what we need to do is try to link up the two, and we'll talk about that next week. It's correlating archaeological chronology with biblical chronology. That can be a bit of a problem if it's not handled correctly. But getting back to our pottery, it's very useful. And in fact, we depend upon it in Palestinian archaeology for dating purposes. Anything that mankind deals with, manufactures, and uses will change through time. People don't like the same old thing. They want the latest, you know, up-to-date edition or version. And so things change. Look at our modern automobile. That's a very good example. You know, the new model always has to be a little different than the old one. Not that it's technically advanced, it may be, but it has to be stylish. You know, it has to be this year's model. It has to be 1992. And you have to be able to tell it's 1992. You don't want people thinking that you, you know, have an older car when you just went out and bought a brand new car. You want them to recognize, he's got a new car. So styles tend to change through time, and it was true with pottery as well. It was manufactured in a different way in different times. There was different decoration applied and different shapes and so on. And by studying these changes through time, then pottery becomes very important for dating purposes. But we can learn more than just dates from pottery. It tells us something of the culture. Many times we can relate pottery to a region, Egypt or Mesopotamia or the Aegean. And when we find these kinds of vessels in Palestine, we know there was international trade going on. So it's valuable for determining trade. Sometimes we can even identify a particular ethnic group. Now, this isn't too common, but there are occasions when this is possible. The best example would be the Philistines. They made a very distinctive type of pottery, much different than the Canaanite pottery. And as soon as the Philistines are on the scene, we know from the pottery that they are there. And so it's very important for identifying people groups at times. So we recover household vessels. Again, it tells us something about how the people live. We know what kind of vessels they use for cooking, what kind of vessels they ate out of, what kind of vessels they stored their goods in. And the Bible talks about pottery vessels, pottery making, and the particular vessels. And we can pretty much identify these things that are discussed in the Old Testament. We can identify the cooking vessels and the jars that Gideon used when he defeated the enemies of Israel. We know exactly what these things look like because we've excavated them. So, pottery vessels, other kinds of vessels, occasionally metal vessels survive. Again, that is often because of the deterioration, but we do have a few metal vessels, and in fact, sometimes we can tell from the pottery vessel that it was copied or made to look like an original metal vessel. The metal vessel would be expensive, and so the poor man's version would be something made in pottery to make it look like metal. Sometimes they even mold the rivets into the pottery vessel to make it look like the original metal. And they would decorate it in such a way as to make it look like metal. Question? Well, we assume that the metal came first. That would be the nicer vessel to own, the more expensive, and we assume that ceramic are just poor man's imitations. Well, I doubt it, because in the pottery we find thousands of them, you know, mass produced. Now, you see this in modern times as well, and it's interesting to see these things. If you've ever traveled in the third world, I guess it's even in the U.S. now, you'll see plastic shoes that are modeled after a leather shoe. They've got, you know, the eyelets, they've got the stitching, they've got everything that looks exactly like a leather shoe, but it's not, it's plastic. And it's the cheaper variety, you know, of the more expensive leather shoe, but it looks very, very close to the leather. Sometimes you can't tell the difference.
One way you can tell the difference, I think, is say certain features are needed in the one kind.
That's right. Yeah.
And useless or decorative.
Redundant. Yes. Right. Right. But you see the exact replication, and so we see that as well in some of these ancient artifacts. Wooden items occasionally, like, you know, along the Dead Sea and some of the caves, you might occasionally find some wooden bowls, wooden spoons, some leather goods, bags, some cloth items. But this stuff is pretty much gone for us as archaeologists. So we're kind of stuck with the pottery, pretty much, as being the thing that we excavate and examine. Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to get into this later, but is, like with the pottery, how much of that is sheer intuition or guesswork, and how much of it is objective that you know that it's a date? I mean, is it just because you found it at a certain level that you can say, well, that's from such a date, or is...
Well, you have to, of course, find it in relation to something that's dateable. And this is the whole name of the game, is to build up this repertoire of well-dated ceramic types. And we're not there yet. I mean, we're still working on it, and there's some problem areas in the ceramic chronology. And I'll talk about some examples later on. The fact that we don't have a lot of written material in Palestine is a handicap, you know, in dating this pottery, but we're working out a good chronology, and some of it is very well dated. In the Iron Age, for example, it's very well dated, but as you go back in earlier times, not so well dated. The interesting thing is that archaeologists think they know the dates, and they're very dogmatic about the dates, but when you really check into it, there's no firm basis for those dates, and so some revisions need to be made.
Yeah. With reference to the written documents, how reliable are the information contained there, considering the fact that, you know, there has been a long history of oral tradition, and when they finally get it down into writing, information has been distorted and corrupted. So how much of the information is reliable, and how much can it shed light upon the scriptures?
Well, you have to take every ancient document on an individual basis, but we're talking here about contemporary documents, pretty much, not copies that were copied over and over. Now, there are some exceptions, like in the some of the legends and stories from Mesopotamia. They were handed down. We have many copies from different time periods, but most of these things that we're dealing with, letters and mundane records and so on, they're contemporary. I mean, you found it in its original context. So you don't have to deal with this problem. But when you get into religious texts and some literary texts, yes, they were handed down, and you get some corruption changes and so on. But a lot of the historical documents from Mesopotamia are original. I mean, they're the contemporary document recording a certain event or things of a king's reign and so on. So you have to look at each one, and that's, you're quite right. That's a possibility that, you know, it could have been copied and recopied. As far as its value to the Bible, again, you have to look at each individual case and evaluate it. Okay, well, we got to move along here if we're going to cover the ground that I hope to cover today. So household vessels of all kinds, mainly pottery, but occasionally some metal items turn up, some tools, maybe weapons. If you're in a dry climate, you might recover some cloth, basketry, wooden items, but those are quite rare. Along the Dead Sea, they've found things like sandals, which is really neat. But normally, those kinds of things don't survive. Tools, occasionally, bronze or iron tools survive. Tell us something about how they worked and how they made things. Now, if you really want to have a lot of illumination on ancient crafts and tools and technology, go to Egypt. It's so dry there that these things have been preserved, and that many times they were placed in the tombs with the dead. And so we have just a whole wealth of material from ancient Egypt. And I don't think it could have been much different in Palestine than it was in Egypt. So if you want to study some technology or craft, go to Egypt and you'll find a wealth of material there. You'll find all the artifacts, and you will also find tomb paintings where they depict these kinds of things being done in antiquity. So Egypt is just a tremendous wealth of information for illuminating ancient life and culture, and I think it was pretty much the same, you know, in that whole area. Cult objects are often found in household contexts, in religious contexts, in temples. I mentioned weapons. Many times weapons were buried with the deceased, and so we get a good idea of what kind of weapons they used in antiquity. Sculpture. Fairly rare in Palestine, but occasionally we find some sculptured materials. Other kinds of artwork, again, quite rare, but once in a while we do find some sorts of artwork. And jewelry, particularly in tombs, you might find some gold or other kinds of jewelry, precious stones and so on. One problem with these burials is that they were looted in antiquity because they knew there was valuable material in that tomb. And so usually, normally, they were looted before the archaeologists can ever get to them. But occasionally we do have some remaining examples of jewelry. So that's just, in general, the kind of material we're dealing with in archaeological work, the written documents, the unwritten documents. Now, in the short time we have left, I want to just touch a bit on methodology and hopefully dating. Now, I mentioned the fact that in the Middle East, we find that the ancient cities are usually buried under these mounds of earth and debris, which we refer to as a tell. Now, if a site was not occupied as much, it would not, of course, build up this big high mound, and it would be sort of a just a flat site. And in that case, we refer to it as a kirbet, K-H-I-R-B-E-T. That's an Arabic word. Again, it means an ancient ruin, but it's a flat ruin. It's not a built-up, accumulated mound. Now, as I say, these mounds were built up layer after layer, and so when we come to excavate them, we are going down through various levels of occupation. We refer to these levels as strata. Singular would be stratum. And so that would refer to a phase of occupation at a particular site. And when you look in the site reports, you'll see them referring to stratum 1, stratum 2, stratum 3, and these are the different periods of occupation, usually distinguished by a change in architecture. It might be a destruction, or for some reason the place was abandoned, rebuilt, and when there's this kind of a discontinuity, it's readily apparent, and so you assign it a new number. Now, not everybody uses that term of stratum. That's one of the problems in biblical archaeology or Palestinian archaeology, is there's no unified set of terminology, unfortunately. So some people talk about phase one, phase two, phase three. Other people are talking about strata, stratum one, stratum two, and so on. But if you get the general idea of what they're talking about, that's what's important. But you may run into different terminology. When we approach an ancient site, of course, we cannot excavate the site 100%. So usually it's kind of a roundish shape, and we have to be selective about where we're going to excavate. Normally the important buildings were on a high place somewhere within the city. This we refer to as the Acropolis, and it's where the king's palace would have been, the main temples would have been, and the administrative areas would have been. So usually we will target the Acropolis for excavation because hopefully the most important information will be derived from this area. Hopefully we'll find an archive of documents detailing the history of our town. Doesn't happen too often in Palestine. But at any rate, you usually want to excavate the more important buildings. And then, as I mentioned, you want to investigate the fortification system, so you will look for a gate, and usually you'll see a big kind of a higher area, and kind of guess maybe that's where the gate is located. So you'll probably try to excavate the gate and make a cut somewhere through the city wall to get the history of the fortification system and the method of construction and so on. So we have to be selective in our excavation, pick certain areas depending on what we're interested in, what we're looking for, but this is the kind of reasoning an archaeologist would go through as he is deciding where he is going to excavate. Excavation today is a very scientific undertaking. It's very slow, very methodical, and so you cannot cover a large area. So you have to be very selective. Now, in our modern day, we use what is called a stratigraphic excavating methodology. And that is simply to go through this tell layer by layer very carefully. You just don't go plowing through all of this material looking for treasure. You want to recover all of the data, all of the information that you can, and so you do it very carefully, layer by layer. And this careful excavation technique we refer to as stratigraphic excavation. Question? Well, look on your handout there. It should be with the terminology. Yeah. Acropolis. AC, look at the first one on your list. Now, we usually dig in squares. We lay out an area, which we would call a field normally, or you might refer to it as an area, and then you would lay out squares, usually 5 meters on a side. That's the standard, but it depends on the area you're digging and what your goals are and so on, but if you are able, you would normally lay out 5 meter squares. And this is where you would dig, and we would put a supervisor in charge of each square, someone to record the data and to more or less supervise the work. between the squares, you leave a 1 meter area, which you do not excavate, and this we call a balk. This is a very important feature of modern excavation because by leaving this balk, you will have a vertical section which will record for you, or it will be a record, of the history of your square. You will see all of the various layers and the destructions and the buildings and whatever happened in this square that you're digging. You will have it there in the balk. So the analysis of the balk and the recording of what's in the balk is a very important feature of modern excavation technique. And we'll be looking at some balk drawings later on in the course. But you need to draw that balk, photograph it, and make sure you understand everything that's in that balk and can label it. And that balk then would become a part of your report as far as giving the record of what transpired in that area. Question?
What is 5 meters?
It's very arbitrary. That's just a comfortable area to work in. It's not too big, not too small. If it's much smaller than that, it's too hard to work inside the square. If it gets much bigger than that, it's too much work to excavate the whole thing. So you divide up into these teams with a supervisor and a few workers, and you dig a 5 by 5 meter square. I guess through experience, it's been found to be the sort of the optimum area for excavating. No. It's very arbitrary. Our primary unit that we use for recording purposes is the locus, plural loci. And this is anything that you can define, basically. It can be a layer of soil that you can distinguish from the soil above and below, or it could be even a pocket of soil. Anything that's distinguishable from the material around it. It can be something man-made, a wall, a floor, a pit, an oven. But as we excavate, when we come to something different, we assign it a locus number. And this becomes our primary unit in the excavation. And it's the numbering system that we use as we record our data from our square. The pottery that we are digging is always related to a locus. And the pottery will be placed in a bucket and given a number, a bucket number and so on, but the locus number will be on there. And when you get to a new locus, then you change pottery buckets and you put it in a new bucket so that you keep your material separated from these different features, different levels, different floors, different rooms, whatever, so that when you go back to study that pottery, you know exactly where it came from, and by dating the pottery, you can date that feature. And so it's very important to keep your artifacts separated and to always have them related to a specific locus. Question?
This
within each square, you will have your own set of locus numbers that you use. Each square will have a number, and then within that square, you'll have your own series of locus numbers, pottery bucket numbers, so you can keep the material all separate one from another. So this is the basic system that is in use in Palestinian archaeology today, the locus system, we call it. Now, there's differences of opinion exactly how far you should carry this kind of technique. It was developed primarily by Kathleen Kenyon in her work at Jericho in the 1950s. And she believed you should separate out every little layer of soil and every possible item or feature that could be separated. The Israelis don't agree with that. They have a different approach. They say, well, this is too time-consuming. It doesn't tell us anything. And they adopt the principle of pretty much digging by architectural units. They'll keep the rooms of a building separated and give it a room number. But they don't go so far as to assign every little feature in the room a separate number. But they're coming more toward the locus system and the people who were super careful with the dividing up of their material. They're coming more toward the Israeli method. So I think there's more of a kind of a meeting of the ways today. In the literature in years past, there was a big discussion about these different methods and who was right and who was wrong. It depends what you're looking for. The Israelis say you need to expose a large area to have any knowledge about this place you're digging, about the buildings, what they were used for, and so on. The Americans primarily, who use this locus system, said, well, it's very unscientific. You must go very carefully and distinguish all these layers and so on. And each is right to a certain extent. But the Israelis now are doing more with bulk drawings. In years past, they did not record their bulks. But now they're doing more of that. And the Americans are doing more of area exposure. So this gives you an idea of the two kind of extremes, and today we're kind of using a combination. The architectural methodology is referred to as the Fisher method. Clarence Fisher was an archaeologist back in the 20s and 30s, and this was the way he recorded his materials, by rooms, by architectural units, and the Israelis, by and large, have followed the Fisher method. This very careful stratigraphic methodology we refer to as the Wheeler-Kenyon method. Wheeler was an archaeologist in Britain, developed the technique there. Kenyon brought it to Palestine and adapted it to Palestine, and so we call it the Wheeler-Kenyon method, very careful stratigraphic excavation. Another question?
I just have a question about the Wheeler method. How does the new locus found?
You have a series of numbers. Let's say, for example, we're going to call this square 1 here, square 2. So in square 1, the first locus will be 1,001. That will be the surface material. So then you begin to dig down. And so the next locus will be 1,002, brown earth. And then you get through that and you see, wow, now I've got lighter colored earth, so that's going to be 1,003. Then you hit a wall, okay, that's going to be 1,004. Then you hit a pit, 1,005, and so on. You just keep assigning a new number to each feature as you come to it.
How is this different from
Oh, yes, yes. The loci are not related to any particular level or stratum. You just keep that numbering system going until you get to the bottom of your square, to bedrock or to when you finish. Then you later on sort out which layer each locus goes with. And that's a very complex process to do that, to really analyze it and figure out where each locus belongs in the history of the area that you're digging. Well, I see our time is about up. I wanted to say just a quick word about dating in Palestine. First and foremost, we use pottery. That's our most important means of dating our material in Palestine. Now, if you can, if you do find some written record, that is very helpful for dating purposes, because from the style of the writing, we can date that written item quite accurately, usually. So written records are very valuable, very helpful, but as I've said before, we usually do not find them. If we find coins, these are, of course, useful because they will give the name of a king or the year of a king or something like that. So from about 500 B.C. onwards, we can use coins. But before 500 B.C., there were no coins, so we're dependent upon pottery. Sometimes other artifacts are helpful, tools and jewelry and so on, but it's not nearly as good as the pottery, and we've got usually an abundance of pottery from a site, so that becomes the number one means of dating. Now, we may have some written records, some historical information about the site we're digging, for example, the Bible. It may tell us something about when people lived there, when it was occupied. And this, of course, must be used for dating as well. Because, you know, if this document says somebody lived there in the Iron Age, well, we should expect to find material from the Iron Age. And so our written records are helpful in working out the history of the site and in dating our material. Carbon-14 is not used very extensively in Palestinian archaeology. We find our pottery gives us better dating than the carbon-14 dates. They're typically all over the lot. Many times they do not agree with our historical dates, and so they are not used to any extent until you get back to very early times when you don't have pottery. Now, pottery began to be used about 5500 B.C., so if you're dealing with cultures older than that, you don't have the pottery, so you're sort of forced to use carbon-14 dating. It's very inaccurate when you get back into those early times. It's fraught with all kinds of problems, but it's all that we have, and so it's used, and the numbers are quoted, and they're treated as truth. Whether or not they are is another matter. There's no way to check them. That's all there is to it. But for the historical period, from the early bronze onward, we don't depend on carbon-14 at all. Question? Yes, this is the dating of organic material. You can use this method on anything that was once living. Something grown, a tree, for example, grain, cloth, anything of that sort. Living, you could probably explain this better than I could. Living material absorbs carbon and gives off carbon. It decays, I guess, radioactively, and it reaches an equilibrium. When the organism dies, it ceases to take in the carbon, but it continues to decay. And you can measure that rate of decay and determine how long the organism has been dead by measuring this radioactive decay. And so theoretically, then it'll tell you that this thing has been